The following audio is machine generated. Please excuse any mispronunciations. Review of Preston Sprinkles From Genesis to Junia by John Whitaker. Preston Sprinkles' new book, From Genesis to Junia, recounts his quest to understand the Bible's teaching on women in church leadership. Spoiler alert, he concludes in favor of egalitarianism. Because of the topic and Sprinkles' large following, this book has created quite a stir. In fact, it generated over 3 times the number of pre-sales of any book he has written. Preston and I are friends, and I was at his launch party for this book. And as with all friendships, there are going to be disagreements from time to time. But let's start with points of agreement. Much to agree with. Number one, influential women in the Old Testament and in Jesus' ministry. Sprinkle admirably highlights many of the significant and influential women in the Old Testament and the Gospels. He even reminds us how surprising it is that the first witnesses to the resurrection, the ones who announced it to the apostles, were women such as Mary Magdalene. Women have played powerful roles, even leadership roles, throughout the Old Testament and the Gospels. Number two, influential women in the early church and in Paul's ministry. Sprinkle continues his survey of the important roles women play in the Bible by looking at the early church and Paul's ministry. Paul calls women co-workers, deacons, and patrons. Women serve as hosts to house churches. They played a prominent and important role in the early church. Number three, the meaning of head. Sprinkle's treatment of the word head, kephel, is helpful. He spent 5 months reading all the literature on the word and concluded that kephel almost always conveys some sense of authority, especially when it refers to a person's relationship with other people. Pages 177 to 78. And when ancient writers use kephel in a non-literal way, it almost always conveys some sense of authority. And I think that this is what Paul has in mind here in Ephesians 5, 22 to 23, page 180. As part of this discussion, he explores the notion that kephale means source, concluding that not only does it make more lexical sense to interpret kephale as conveying authority, but it also captures the rhetorical force of what Paul is doing in Ephesians 5, 21 to 33, page 185, in discussing headship in 1 Corinthians 11, 2 to 16. Sprinkle notes that even if kephel means source there, it's unlikely that it means source and not authority, page 213, emphasis original. Number four, the treatment of Ephesians 5:21-33, Sprinkle's discussion of male and female roles in marriage in Ephesians 5:21-33 notes that, as just discussed, kephel, head, conveys authority, but authority patterned after the self-giving love of Jesus. He also points out that only wives are told to submit in this passage. You know, from my vantage point, I don't see Paul directly telling husbands to submit to their wives, and yet he clearly challenges typical hierarchical assumptions about submission and authority, pushing toward a kind of mutuality in marriage that was revolutionary in the first century, page 188. Number five, resting with 1 Corinthians. Sprinkle wrestles helpfully with two difficult passages from 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 11, 2-16 is notoriously hard, including unclear phrases and confusing logical connections. Yet, in spite of all the difficulties, one thing is perfectly clear. Women prayed and prophesied out loud in church. Sprinkle helpfully wrestles with the ambiguities of this text, concluding that Paul appeals to man's priority in creation to argue that married women should wear culturally appropriate attire as a sign of their husband's authority. Page 208. His treatment of 1 Corinthians 14:34 to 35 is on target as well. He shows that this is not a blanket statement, but that Paul's concern in this section of 1 Corinthians is with order in worship. That's why all three uses in 1 Corinthians of the specific word for be silent appear in the very paragraph where verses 34 to 35 are found. Paul tells tongue speakers, prophets, and women to be silent. Paul is commanding women to not interrupt another prophet while he or she is speaking, but to submit to the one speaking, page 231. I found myself agreeing with a lot of the biblical conclusions in the first 237 pages of the book, and the book is only 262 pages long. For sure, there were some disagreements, as I'll note below, but through nine chapters, Sprinkle built a case that is consistent with and in many ways supportive of a nuanced complementarian position. Chapter 10, however, is where we significantly diverged. Before looking at that chapter, as well as a few other specific points of disagreement, I first want to consider a few general problems with Sprinkle's case for egalitarianism. Some logical problems. Defining leadership as service. As discussed above, Sprinkle correctly highlights a number of influential women in the Bible, concluding that they were leaders. He points out that Jesus redefines leadership in terms of service rather than greatness. He frames all of this as our search for women leaders, page 93. Then he says, if we take Jesus' words about leaders being servants seriously, then we're not looking for women who have ascended to the top like some CEO who climbed the corporate ladder. Perhaps we're not even looking for women with badges and titles or ones who have been ordained to a clear ministry position. Instead, we should be looking for a servant with towel in hand, page 93. But wait, this language only muddies the waters. The very question being debated is about definite leadership positions. If titles and ordination don't matter, why are we even discussing this subject? The overarching question he pursues in this book is whether women can occupy certain specific ministry positions that have titles, for example, elder slash overseer, deacon, etc., and often require some kind of ordination. Sprinkle seems to imply that since servanthood is at the heart of Jesus' vision of leadership, then all servants are leaders. I know he knows this isn't the case, but he makes a handful of statements throughout the book, like the one above, that suggest if you find a servant, you found a leader. But this is an erroneous understanding of Jesus' words. The point of Jesus' teaching is not that the janitor is the one who actually leads the company. His point is that the leader of the company should have the heart that would make him a good janitor. In other words, not every servant is a leader, but every leader must be a servant. Jesus knows that there are people in positions of power and leadership, many who even bear titles. He's not trying to eliminate those positions. He is offering a fresh vision for how the people who occupy those positions posture themselves and behave within those positions. In women leaders in the Bible, therefore, related to this, Sprinkle repeatedly mentions that there were women in influential positions all throughout the Bible and describes them as leaders. As noted above, he frames the case he's making as searching to see if there were women leaders in the Bible. His reasoning seems to be that if we find women acting as leaders, then this proves egalitarianism. So he says things like, if God had commanded that only men can lead, then even one deviation, i.e. one example of a female leader from his command, wouldn't be just an exception to the rule. It would be immoral, page 64, italics in the original. Or, thus far, I think there's a case for female leaders in the New Testament, page 117. His thinking appears to be that if women are leaders in any way, then they can be leaders in every way. But this doesn't logically follow. Leadership in one position or five positions does not necessitate leadership in every position. We can imagine a large organization with 10 different kinds of leadership positions available, and 9 of them could be occupied by females. But for whatever reason, one position could only be filled by males. You could identify plenty of female leaders in records about the organization, and yet there'd still be one position that was male only. The presence of some or even many female leaders doesn't equate to full egalitarianism. In the same way, the presence of some or many female leaders in the Bible doesn't necessarily lead to egalitarianism, as Sprinkle seems to assume. This is also the problem with Sprinkle's survey of leadership terms in the New Testament. In chapter 4, he spends a lot of time surveying all the different ways the New Testament speaks about leaders, which is actually helpful. And he argues from this data that since these terms are applied to females, then we should conclude that females were leaders in Paul's ministry. Based on what we've said above, I trust you can see the logical problem with this. Just because women, or even men for that matter, were leaders in some capacity doesn't mean they were or can be leaders in every capacity. Describing the first century world. One final logical problem with Sprinkle's case is the inconsistency regarding how he presents the nature of the first century world. Was it male-dominated so that giving women status and position was countercultural? Or did women have significant amounts of influence and power when making a point about how the original Greco-Roman readers would have heard the narratives in the Gospels about the faithfulness of the women disciples, in contrast to the faithlessness of male disciples? Sprinkle describes the culture of those original readers as male-dominated, where women were considered less significant, less moral, less wise, and less virtuous than men, page 84. But when arguing that in a first century house church, the woman of the house would have been a de facto leader in the church, he argues that women in Greco-Roman culture had leadership roles in civic, religious, and even political spheres, page 110, and contends that they often wielded more power and authority over the management of the household than their husband. A house church was thus a place where the woman was likely in charge, pages 110 to 11. Sprinkle seems to offer an inconsistent reconstruction of the data, which stacks the deck in favor of egalitarianism. A few points of disagreement. Here, I want to note a handful of points of disagreement from chapters 1 to 9, even though I noted above how much I found to agree with. Number one, the framing of women in Jesus' ministry. Sprinkle acknowledges that he knows no complementarian who would deny that Jesus valued women and women played a significant role in his ministry. He also admitted that the evidence for women in leadership can be stretched further than the gospel writers intended, page 66. And yet it seems that this is what he did. He surveys each of the four gospels, not only highlighting the significance of women in Jesus' ministry, but arguing that women are held up as the model disciples and the men, especially the apostles, are faithless. I'm still struck, Sprinkle writes, by the way the gospel writers contrast the women's faithfulness with the faithlessness of the 12, especially if we assume that the 12 were being trained to be leaders in the early church, the page 84. Women, not men, are described as servants, and this is the key leadership descriptor for Jesus, page 86. He argues, not only do the apostles serve as a negative foil for genuine discipleship, but in the Gospels, it's women more than men who serve as examples of the leadership virtues Jesus talked about, page 89. He even says that the Gospels depict the women as exemplary preachers of the divine word to men because they witnessed and announced the resurrection, page 84. But Sprinkle overplays his hand in this chapter. He magnifies the virtues of women and exaggerates the failures of men, especially the 12. Women are said to demonstrate radical obedience to Jesus. Once again, in contrast to men, women demonstrate faithfulness, courage, hope, sacrifice, suffering, generosity, hospitality, page 84, not men. The men are fragile and faithless, page 84. But what about Joseph, who courageously took Mary as his wife after a visit from the angel? Or Peter, Andrew, James, and John, who left their nets and their father to radically follow and obey Jesus? Or the commendation of Peter for his bold confession of Jesus, Matthew 16:16-18? Sure, there are plenty of places the 12 fall short and Jesus corrects them, but there are also plenty of times they model faithfulness too. It's unnecessary and unpersuasive to overinflate their shortcomings and to overmagnify the women's virtues. In the end, the argument of this chapter that the women should be held up as the main leaders is unfounded because we know that the 12 are, in fact, men. They are the ones Jesus has chosen to lead his mission. And although women played influential roles and were often excellent models of discipleship, that did not promote them to every position of leadership, nor does it disqualify the men from their appointed position of leadership. Based on Sprinkle's logic, it seems like Jesus should have chosen 12 women to be apostles rather than 12 men, but he didn't, which leads to the next point. Number two, 12 male apostles. Sprinkle doesn't dodge this fact, and that's commendable. He even notes that when the 11 apostles sought a replacement for Judas, they specified that they needed to choose a replacement from among the men, Andren, Acts 1:21, even though there were many faithful women available, page 88. This used to be a slam dunk argument for complementarianism in his mind, but now he's not so sure, though he still thinks it has some merit. Yeah, page 88. I appreciate that Sprinkle doesn't dismiss this fact on the basis of the culture of the day, since Jesus, countercultural as ever, clearly had women following him around as disciples and part of his entourage. So why does he no longer think this is a slam dunk argument? He offers two reasons. First, the 12 apostles represent a reconstituted 12 tribes of Israel, since the 12 tribes derive from 12 male patriarchs, sons of Jacob. The 12 apostles had to be male for the symbolism to work, page 88, emphasis original. This is actually a fairly established understanding of why Jesus chose 12 apostles. Sprinkle then draws this conclusion. The sex of the 12, then, is irrelevant for the sex of future church leaders of the church, page 88. The fact that they are males is only part of the analogy with the 12 patriarchs, and is intended to be symbolic of Israel's past, not determinative of the church's future, page 89. But this conclusion doesn't follow from the premises. We actually need some reasons for why this doesn't also look forward to the church's future. All the argument offers is where the idea of 12 men came from in the past, but it offers no reason for why this is irrelevant to church leadership in the future. It appears that it is very relevant to that question, since these 12 men are described as the foundation of the church. It seemed to me that this first reason fails to make the case. And second, Sprinkle argues that in the Gospels, the 12 aren't very good examples of what leadership looks like, page 89. I've already pointed out that I think he overstates this, but even if this were the case, this would in no way dismiss the fact that Jesus chose these 12 men. Whether good leaders or not, Jesus still entrusted the leadership of his enterprise to them. Number three, Phoebe, Priscilla, Junia, Romans 16. Complementarians and egalitarians celebrate the contributions of brave, faithful women like these three. But I want to make a few observations about how these three are used to build a case for egalitarianism. First, these three clearly were influential and important women in the early church. But as explained above, being a leader in one capacity doesn't equate to being a leader in every capacity. We can't conclude from the significant roles these women played that there are no gender-based leadership distinctions in the early church. So it's true that Priscilla is called Paul's co-worker in ministry, and she and Aquila hosted churches in their homes, but to refer to her as an early church leader, page 137, and by that to mean that she occupied the same role as a male elder is inaccurate and unpersuasive. Second, often the case for egalitarianism using these three women entails going beyond what the text actually says, almost like building a 2,400 square foot house on a 100 square foot foundation. I see some of that here in Sprinkle's work. Take Phoebe, for example. Using some historical background, Sprinkle helps us appreciate who this woman might have been as a patron and servant deacon of the church. It's possible that she was the person who delivered that letter to the Romans, though the text doesn't make this explicit. Noting this possibility, however, Sprinkle goes beyond the text to speculate based on what we know about ancient letters that she could have read or performed the letter to the Romans and explain things as she went. Implication, she was the first person who ever preached the book of Romans. But the text says nothing about her role in delivering or reading or explaining the letter. And thankfully, Sprinkle acknowledges this, saying he wants to be cautious because these things aren't certain, page 129. Unfortunately, in his conclusion to the chapter, he states it as a fact, saying Paul entrusts her with carrying and performing his most important letter at the crux of his ministry, page 149. Especially since Junia makes the title of Sprinkle's book, we should say a bit about her. Here's what Romans 16:7 says about her. Greet Andronicus and Junia, my kinsfolk and my fellow prisoners, who are outstanding in the view of the apostles, who also were in Christ before me, NASB. The fact that she and her husband are referred to as fellow prisoners is a key reason she ended up in the title. Sprinkle builds a lot of this phrase and returns to it for persuasive appeal in the conclusion to the book. He describes in detail the horrific conditions of Roman prisons and notes that women in prison often face the constant threat of sexual assault and rape, pages 147 to 48. Then he adds that it is remarkable that Junia not only endured such a hellhole, but also continued her apostolic duties after she was released, page 148. All of this goes beyond what the text actually says. We don't know what, if any, apostolic duties Junia had. She may not have even endured the hellhole Sprinkle describes. Paul uses the word prisoner to describe himself in Ephesians 3:1 and the exact phrase fellow prisoner in Colossians 4:10 to describe Aristarchus, but both of those letters are written while Paul is under house arrest, not a hellhole, as described in Acts 28. We must guard against building a lot off very little. Oftentimes, the conclusions drawn from the mention of these three women aren't supported by what the Bible actually says about them. While there are a few other things I might quibble over from the first nine chapters of the book, the main point of divergence comes in chapter 10. So let's turn to what Sprinkle says about 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy 2, 8 to 15. This passage is critical to this debate, and Sprinkle gives considerable attention to it. The key verses are 2:11-12. A woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness, but I do not allow a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man, but to remain quiet. NASB. And the key phrase is to teach or to exercise authority over. The word translated, exercise authority, is authentine. This is the only use of this verb in the New Testament, and there are few surviving uses outside the New Testament that help us understand how the word was being used at the time Paul wrote 1 Timothy. The question is, does the word refer to having authority in a neutral sense, or does it refer to authority in a negative sense, such as using authority in a domineering way? Sprinkle helpfully includes and briefly reviews all the passages in ancient literature where this word is used so you can read them yourself. He concludes that the word refers to negative domineering authority, so that 1 Timothy 2:12 is not excluding women from having authority over men in general, only using domineering authority. He also contends that the teaching that is prohibited is negative domineering teaching, see page 261. But why forbid only the women from exercising domineering authority and domineering teaching? Paul writes that he doesn't allow a woman, so does he allow a man to teach and exercise authority in a domineering manner? It seems an odd thing to say. I suppose someone might argue that women in the church in Ephesus were the ones with the problem, but this doesn't fit the context in 1 Timothy. In 1 Timothy 1:20, Paul names two men who have been part of the problem in Ephesus. And in 2 Timothy 3:6, written while Timothy is still ministering in Ephesus, Paul describes men who take advantage of weak, vulnerable women. So certainly domineering men are a problem for the church in Ephesus. So why single out only the women and prohibit them from being domineering? Also, I find Sprinkle's reasoning for why the verb authentine, exercise authority, refers to negative authority unconvincing. He argues that it is negative because it's used in context of social hierarchy, including masters and slaves. So he contends it refers to a worldly kind of authority where people act like tyrants and lord it over others, page 253, contrary to Jesus's vision for authority. His argument is not that the context where it is used shows the authority figure acted badly, thus making the word negative. Rather, in his mind, it's the bare fact of hierarchy that makes the kind of authority referred to by the verb negative. His basic argument looks like this, that the verb is used in hierarchical contexts, including slave masters. Such hierarchy is negative based on Jesus's teaching. Therefore, the verb authentine is negative. But this seems to misunderstand word meanings as well as Jesus's teaching about authority. Social hierarchies, including slavery, were simply part of the first century world of Jesus and Paul. And though their hierarchies were a little more defined than ours today, we still have hierarchies today. It's simply the way societies are organized and operate. So just because a word is consistently used in a hierarchical context does not make the word inherently negative. We can see this, for example, with the English word boss. It is always used in a hierarchical context in which one person has control over another, including their livelihood, where bosses can even fire you with a simple text message. And so that might be bad for them, but I know two people who were fired in that very way in the past week. But we don't think the word boss is always negative. It's intrinsically hierarchical, but not intrinsically negative. We need more information about the boss to determine if it's positive or negative. Likewise, simply because the word authentine consistently occurs in hierarchical context doesn't make it intrinsically negative. But what about Jesus' teaching? Whether we like it or not, Jesus' teaching about authority doesn't mean he views hierarchies as necessarily bad, or that he's seeking to dismantle social hierarchies. In fact, Jesus uses the hierarchies of their day, including slaves and masters, to make both negative and positive points. True, he warns about lording it over people and calls his apostles to not act that way, but he also uses the slave-master hierarchy to teach disciples about faithful service in Luke 17, 7 to 10. And elsewhere in that teaching, a slave worked all day, came in at night, and had to serve his master dinner. And Jesus uses all that to make a positive point. Jesus' teaching on authority doesn't mean that any and all authority within hierarchy is intrinsically bad, so that any time we see the word authority in a hierarchical context, we can automatically conclude it's negative. Paul operates the same way in 1 Timothy 6:1 NASB. Paul instructs all who are under the yoke as slaves are to regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and our doctrine will not be spoken against. The word for master here is despots, a term Sprinkle says conveys secular, not Christian authority. See pages 253 to 54. And yet Paul expects slaves to regard this master as deserving of all honor. But what if the master is a Christian? Wouldn't Paul tell them to release their slaves? 1 Timothy 6:2 continues, those who have believers as their masters must not be disrespectful to them because they are brothers or sisters, but must serve them all the more because those who partake of the benefit are believers and beloved as a despots. Like Jesus, Paul doesn't dismantle the hierarchies of the day. Rather, he teaches Christians what it looks to be a good disciple within those hierarchies. Sprinkle's negative view of Authentian largely depends on a denunciation of the hierarchies themselves, which is something we have to impose looking back, not something we see from the biblical writers. So I don't find Sprinkle's reason for understanding Authentian as a negative kind of authority persuasive. And if that's the case, then his main argument for to teach being negative fails as well. In fact, as Sprinkle himself admits, page 258, the word translated to teach is almost always used as a positive thing in the New Testament. The few times it's used in a negative context, it's qualified with an explanatory phrase that makes it clear something negative is happening. For example, see Titus 1:10 to 11. But there is no such qualifying phrase in 1 Timothy 2:12. So it actually makes more sense to assume it's positive in this context. Also, 1 Timothy 2:11 gets only a footnote in this chapter, note 57. Page 260, but the verse is actually very relevant to the discussion. Verse 11 is the positive counterpart to verse 12. Paul writes, a woman must quietly receive instruction with entire submissiveness, NASB. Quietly refers to a peaceable spirit and demeanor, not absolute silence, which would contradict what Paul has written elsewhere. And full submission speaks of arranging oneself under authority. So while I appreciated Sprinkle taking the text seriously, I remain unconvinced by his arguments regarding 1 Timothy 2:11 to 12. Male elders. Sprinkle downplays the argument for male-only elders from 1 Timothy 3:1 to 7, as he claims that most English translations contain male-specific language throughout the passage, but the Greek is not male-specific, page 279. This is a half-truth that muddies the waters. The traits listed are masculine in Greek, but in Greek, a mixed group of men and women can be referred to using masculine-gendered words. So one could argue, as Sprinkle does, that if the group of overseers in 1 Timothy 3 were both male and female, the way Paul writes is what you'd find. At the same time, if the group were all male, Paul would write it the exact same way. So you need some indicator of whether the group is mixed or male only. And the fact is, there is an indicator in this passage when Paul writes that overseers must be the husband of one wife on verse 2. he literally says one woman man using the male specific word honor. Therefore, Paul makes it clear that this passage is male specific. This is why every major translation understands it as male specific, and why Sprinkle's contention that it's not male specific turns out to be false. And Sprinkle does address the phrase one woman man and rightly points out that Paul knows how to say it the other way, one man woman. See 1 Timothy 5:9. He thus acknowledges that the phrase is gender specific, page 279. Yet he concludes that this doesn't require overseers to be male, but it is merely descriptive, not prescriptive. He assumes this was the case because of the culture. Within Paul's ancient context, most qualified overseers would have been married men with children, but Paul is not trying to rule out the possibility of women overseers. Page 286. But this is not an argument. It assumes and asserts the conclusion the book is debating rather than arguing for it. Furthermore, it seems inconsistent with Sprinkle's argument earlier in the book that women often had more power in the home than men, and thus they would have been viewed as leaders. See pages 110 to 11. Sprinkle also suggests that being a one-woman man seems to indicate marriage, and Paul mentions overseers having children. He then reasons that if we're not going to require overseers to be married or have kids today, why also require them to be male? But this confuses what is situational. For example, if he has kids, they must obey him, with what is not, that is a person's gender. I don't see how the situational conditions of marriage and family, which Paul himself didn't meet, negate the male-specific language of the passage. By contrast, when discussing deacons immediately after overseers, Paul explicitly includes instructions for males and females, but he doesn't do that for overseers. It remains completely male-specific. Nothing in the passage indicates that the body of overseers included women. Sprinkle also claims in various places throughout the book that the host of the house church probably was a de facto elder, so a female host implies a female elder, pages 110 to 14, compare pages 104 and 133, but we don't see de facto default elders in the churches Paul started. Rather, Paul consistently appointed elders, see Acts 14:23 at the beginning of his ministry and Titus 1:5 near the end. Also, I think it's fair to ask that if the male-specific language of 1 Timothy 3 as well as Titus 1 doesn't require male overseers, why did the church for 1900 years understand it as requiring male overseers? There have been debates about many things during church history, but about the topic of male elders, pastors, priests, or whatever title is used, the church spoke with one voice for 1900 years. Whether women could be ordained as overseers didn't become a pressing question until recently. For more on this question, see, can women serve as elders in the church? 5 questions for egalitarians at renew.org. Conclusion. Preston Sprinkle is a first-rate scholar who spent over 3 years digging deeply into this subject. The book reflects his research, but it's clear and accessible to the average reader, something I've always appreciated about Preston's work. I do not find his case for egalitarianism convincing, but I commend Preston for taking this topic seriously and seeking to wrestle with it deeply. I know his deepest goal is for more people to dig into the biblical text on this subject. We share that goal, and I hope my review helps you, the reader, in this quest. For footnotes, see the article at renew.org.